From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how the Courser Gamrat scandal might get the House moving on a way to fund road repairs.
The legislature's standing with the public was horrible before these scandals, and it's gone through the sub-basement now.
Is a parole questionnaire called Compass giving the best information to the parole board?
I think it's not just that we're releasing the relatively privileged, it's that we're punishing people for being poor.
Bringing more women into the fold as entrepreneurs and investors.
I think it's a tremendous untapped opportunity here in Michigan to help women in other underserved communities understand the opportunity to get involved.
And the heat was on this weekend at the MIS. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. It is tough enough to make it as an entrepreneur, but even tougher if you're a woman.
We have this kind of cultural identity where we don't necessarily think about what it means to invest in the next generation of Michigan companies. I think it's a tremendous untapped opportunity here in Michigan to help women in other underserved communities understand the opportunity to get involved.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, what's at stake if we don't get more diverse investors in Michigan? But first, as the Todd Courser, Cindy Gamrat sex and clumsy cover-up scandal continues to swirl, state lawmakers return to Lansing this week from their month-long summer vacation, and roads are at the top of the agenda. Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry is thinking the Courser-Gamrat scandal just might help move things along in the quest to find a way to fund road repairs. Jack, you very accurately note that getting that road funding plan through the House is going to, in your words, require threading a very delicate needle?
Well, that's right. The Republicans need 55 votes. There's 109 members in the House with one vacancy. And Democrats are not going to support anything the Republicans do. The Republicans have indicated they don't really want any Democratic support. So you would think, well, they have 63 members. 55 should be a piece of cake. But it's not, because a lot of them, a significant number of Republicans, have said they won't vote to support any taxes ever. They've signed pledges to do that. Now, the way the scandal might help is that two of the most fervent anti-tax people were Todd Courser and Cindy Gamrat. They now have no credibility whatsoever. It's not at all certain they'll show up to vote. They're staying in the House for now, but Cindy Gamrat's aide has denounced her as a liar, and they're both being investigated. At any rate, even if they do show up to vote, they're not going to have much leverage, and it's just possible this might enable the Republicans to get, in favor of this latest road plan to get it through the House. We'll have to wait and see.
And as you point out in your latest commentary, you think the Republican leadership is making a big mistake. What is that mistake, Jack?
The mistake is not to involve Democrats at all. They said pretty much go away. We don't want to work with you. Want it to be an all-Republican plan. That's certainly a governing mistake. I mean, roads affect everybody. It's also probably a political mistake. If they could strike a bargain with the Democrats, then if this goes sour, people don't like it, neither party would be totally blamed. Democrats are not going to support this for one major reason, because it requires $600 million in cuts from the general fund, which they suspiciously think is likely to come out of programs that are near and dear to them, things like, social programs, education, things like that. I had suggested that a compromise might be to get the bulk of it out of prisons. There's a general agreement along both parties that we could cut spending on the corrections budget, that we probably have too many people locked up, maybe too many prisons, but they apparently aren't going that way. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Because, you really do make some good points of what could happen if Republicans would extend a hand, work with Democrats, and find those cuts in the corrections budget.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, we don't know whether that would really work or not. We don't know if the Democrats would play ball. Huh. But that might be something, that's the one issue in which I can see there being general willingness to do that. They probably couldn't get all of it out of corrections, certainly not the first year, but people who've looked at this in depth, people who know a whole lot more about it than you or I, say you could certainly have significant savings in the corrections budget if we just went to locking up people we're afraid of rather than those we're mad at. The prison population in Michigan has declined somewhat. It used to be over 50,000, but it's still 44,000. We'd consider that barely 30 years ago, we only had 13,000 in prisons across the state. state when we had virtually the same population, you can see this is a big part of the budget woes.
You know, one would think, Jack, that the legislature and its leaders would really want to serve up some strong positive action and deflect the spotlight from Todd Corser and Cindy Gamrat, or State Senator Virgil Smith, by the way, since we're speaking of scandals.
Well, of course, Virgil Smith is a gift to the Republicans because he's a Democrat, of course, unlike the other two. And the Democrats did not call for his resignation, so they're somewhat compromised here. But yes, the legislature's standing with the public was horrible before these scandals, and it's gone through the sub-basement now. And yes, they would certainly like to show people that they can get something done. They should be worried that people are going to say a plague on both your houses and throw them all out. Gerrymandering makes that harder to do, but still, people are clearly very angry about the roads, and they're not in much of a mood to give any credit to one party or the other.
Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lessenberry. Always a pleasure having you with us, Jack. Thank you so much.
Hope I was coherent, Cindy.
While a million or so car fans crowded Woodward Avenue this weekend for the annual Dream Cruise, another big group of car fans made its way to the Michigan International Speedway for some NASCAR heaven, the Pure Michigan 400. Benjamin Raven of MLive is here now with a wrap-up. A big weekend and a big season for winner Matt Kenseth, no?
Well, he had only led about 147 laps all season, and at Michigan on Sunday, he led 146 laps of the 200 laps on Sunday. And he started from the front, and he ended up in the front. It was just a dominating performance for him out there.
What do you think the new rules package did for him?
It's really hard to tell right now because it was supposed to increase drag, which would slow down the cars a little bit more and bring more passing back to NASCAR and to make it more competitive. But, I mean, you can see it had the opposite effect toward the front. I mean, his crew chief after the race was saying that there was a lot of passing in the middle of the pack and toward the rear, but Kent choked around that, saying that he didn't see much of the race rather than what he could see from his rear-view mirror. So right now it was only the second race with those rules. They're not going to use them for the big chase for the championship, so I think that kind of speaks volumes about them. So I didn't see much changes out there.
And we were all talking over the weekend about the weather and the heat and what it would be like to be at MIS. So what was that like, not only for the drivers, but for those of you who were there watching the thing? Nowhere to hide.
No, there was nowhere to hide. The sun was just hot. It was humid. Sunday was the worst for sure. I would walk around kind of the upper level above the media room, and you would see people at the start of the race, and then you go up there maybe 40 minutes later, and they've removed their first shirt, and they're down to their tank tops, and they're brushing fans and pouring water on their head. It was blistering. I don't know how those drivers made it through the race.
Yeah. Any guesstimate on what the temperature was like for those drivers?
Listening to on the headsets to the race, you could hear the drivers talking back and forth with their crew chiefs. And then on the NBC Sports broadcast, early on in the race, they were saying that, I think it was Casey Mears' car was registering temperatures about 150 to 155 degrees inside of his car. I mean, you can cook eggs at that temperature.
Wow. I can't even get my mind around that. And I will say personally, I don't think you could pay me enough to sit there and sizzle. But I know it was a big weekend for fans, very sentimental weekend for Jeff Gordon and his fans, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It was a huge deal. Jeff Gordon, one of the most legendary drivers of all time. He's had so much success at Michigan in his two-decade-long career. He's got 3 wins at Michigan. He won there last year. He's been in the top 10, I believe, 19 times. So a lot of emotions around that.
Because this was his last time, wasn't it? Last race at MIS?
Yeah, he announced that this would be his last full-time season as a driver. And this was definitely his last race at Michigan. It was sounding like, if you remember that Derek Jeter retiring for the Yankees, he would get gifts every time he would go to the last ballpark. Gordon's been getting gifts. The track president at MIS gave him a 4-night stay to the Grand Hotel, and they just kind of honored him with the weekend, just kind of give him a big going-out party.
How about fan reaction? Any special fan reaction?
Yeah, on the 24th lap of the race, MIS PA announcer told everyone to get on their feet, gave a salute to Gordon. He drives the 24 car, of course, on the 24th lap, so that was kind of cool to see the 100-plus thousand people on their feet cheering the guy on. Whether they want him to win or not, they respected him.
Yeah. Now, it's probably worth mentioning NASCAR has asked fans not to bring Confederate flags, not to display them, but there were plenty on display over the weekend, weren't there?
Yes, there were. I mean, there are a ton of independent vendors that are set up that traveled the NASCAR circuit throughout the season, and
I mean, they're selling like NASCAR shirts, and then right next to them, you got Confederate flag shirts. And obviously, these aren't official NASCAR merchandise, the Confederate flag stuff, but I mean, it was hard to miss. I mean, right across the street from the entrance where you have to go in, most of the media people, the vendor tent's got a huge Confederate flag for sale. You know, walking around Sunday, I saw a shirtless guy draped in a Confederate flag. They might have asked people to keep them at home, but I don't know. I don't know if it was more than the last time around or not, but it was definitely still hard to miss.
Any reaction from fans, pro or con, to that?
No, I actually did not see much reaction to that. There was supposed to be kind of a service going on where people could turn their Confederate flag in for an American flag, and I got to be honest, I did not see that booth or hear anything about it. I didn't see much difference between the June race and the August race with it.
Hmm. Well, I got to imagine you're probably pretty grateful to be cooling off inside of air conditioning today after that sizzling weekend at the Michigan International Speedway. Benjamin Raven of MLive bringing us up to speed on what happened at the Pure Michigan 400. Thanks so much for talking with us, Benjamin.
All right. Thank you. Anytime.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The details of the affair between State Representatives Todd Courser and Cindy Gamrat, along with Courser's attempt to cover up and smear himself with a fake gay sex scandal, have made national, even worldwide headlines. The two Tea Party conservative Christian lawmakers at the center of this scandal are only the latest in a long and colorful history of political scandals in Michigan. Detroit Free Press columnist Nancy Kaffer is with us now. Nancy, since this thing broke, a lot of people have been looking back to recent history, to the Kwame Kilpatrick-Christine Beattie scandal, but there sure is a lot of dirt to dish about that predates that one. You take us back to 1939 to Mayor Richard Redding. Tell us about this one.
So there was a woman named Janet McDonald who killed herself and her young daughter, which is awful to start off with. And then she had sent notes to the newspapers saying that her former lover, who was a bookie, had been paying bribes to the Detroit police to protect his gambling racket. There was an investigation at the time. Apparently, Richard Redding had not wanted to investigate the police department, which the city council felt sort of like, why on earth is he not wanting to investigate the police department? Turns out because he was taking kickbacks.
Surprise!
He was taking pay for promotions, and he was convicted on some corruption charges, sentenced to 4 to 5 years in prison. And when he was convicted, his comment was, "This is the greatest injustice since the crucifixion of Christ." So
a man with a
reasonable sense of proportion.
Absolutely. And then we had Oakland County's famous bigamist judge, the Honorable William Beer.
Now, I don't know if he actually married the second family. He was a judge that had been married to his first wife for decades. They had some kids, and then he started a new family with his secretary, who was then 19. They had 9 children together, so he had 3 kids with one woman, his wife, and then 9 children with it. But this wasn't an issue of like he was having an affair on the side. He had an established like 2 households and was a part of these households. But then the more serious thing is he appears to have made some just really shocking decisions as a judge, including in one rape case. He was retired from the bench and was a visiting judge at this time. In one rape case, it was a convicted rapist and could have been sentenced to 15 years in jail. And this Judge Beer gave him a year of freedom to see if he could behave himself before, which is crazy.
Yeah.
The upshot of it was we changed the law that you can't have a delayed or suspended sentence in a rape conviction. So, silver lining?
I guess, yeah. Nancy, many in Michigan have a pretty cynical view of our state legislature, and in the big story in Sunday's Free Press, you kind of point out that the big house fiscal agency scandal of 1993 could be a big reason why we're so cynical. What was that about?
Yeah, so there. I mean, this was before my time, so I don't know what the mood was at the time. But in the reporting that I read on it, seems like this was a scandal that really made people change their view of how state government operated and the trust they should put in it. This was the House Fiscal Agency. Some employees were essentially using it as a personal piggy bank to pay credit cards, to go on vacations, buy furniture, dental work, social event, pay taxes. And there were also some faked up bills for non-existent contract workers. In the big scheme of things, agency employees only defrauded the state of about $2 million, which is not a huge amount of money, but the damage to public trust and the reliability of the state government seems to have taken a pretty big blow from this.
It was interesting reading the seven worst political scandals in Michigan history. We had Detroit City Council member Kay Everett. She of the famous, beautiful hats got into some hot water and sausage was involved.
Yes, she was indicted on a variety of charges, including taking bribes. And one of the allegations made was that part of the bribe had been paid in sausage, 17 pounds of it, which is just, how does that even happen? Like, how do you even get to that point in the conversation? I'd like you to consider voting for me. And by the way, I've got some sausage. Allegedly. She passed away before she could be brought to trial on these charges, so we'll never really know the truth of what happened, whether, you know, these charges would be proven or whether they were, we'll never know.
And as this, your story says, the puns are way too many to count with this story.
They sure are. Political sausage making. It's a crazy story.
Nancy, we have to talk about David Jay. And this is not all that long ago, because this is kind of how we started the 21st century in Michigan with the antics of this Republican state senator. Take us through the laundry list.
He was the first state lawmaker to ever be expelled from the state Senate. In our archives, a longtime political associate of Jay's described his personal life as a very weird spectacle around the time of his expulsion in 2001. I think you could actually describe sort of his whole legislative career as a very weird spectacle. He was notorious for race baiting, for making, playing up suburban-urban differences, talking badly about Detroit. One point, supposedly dropped a pistol on the legislative floor, fell out of his pocket.
I remember that.
This is all before my time.
The drunken driving arrests.
Drunken driving arrests. Yes, he had several drunken driving arrests. Then there was a domestic violence charge, which led directly to the expulsion hearings. One of the things that kind of came through in reading this stuff about scandals is that the conduct of the lawmakers may really be what drives their colleagues to snap. It's the behavior around this stuff. It's like, if you're going to be dropping guns in the Capitol and generally making a spectacle of yourself, then there may not be as much tolerance for these peccadilloes.
And we probably need to politically balance things out, because as wild and crazy as the antics of Republican David Jay, we had Detroit Democrat Henry Stallings II. Where do you even begin with that laundry list?
Boy, so he was sort of elected on a fluke. His Senate district had been the longtime safe seat of a lawmaker named David Holmes, who died unexpectedly shortly after the filing deadline. Stallings had filed to run. The state legislature tried to change the laws to say that other people could file to run. Apparently people weren't real excited about the idea of Stallings getting a state Senate seat. He's kind of an also-ran at that time. He sued, saying that they couldn't change the filing deadline, and won. He took the seat, and then he had had some sort of small change legal problems. Like, there had been a paternity suit where at first he said he had no idea who the woman who claimed to have his child was, and then shocker, it really was his child. He had a bankruptcy. He had not paid child support for some of his other children, not the paternity suit child, but other children. And then in 1996, he was charged with using a state worker to frame pictures in his Detroit art gallery, using some campaign contributions to pay his rent and failing to pay sales and withholding taxes for his business. So this went on for years. These charges were brought in 1996. In 1998, they were starting expulsion proceedings, and he resigned apparently moments ahead of the expulsion vote.
When you look at this, the hierarchy that you've spelled out of Michigan political scandals, where do you think the Corser Gamrat scandal is going to rank?
I had to say, so there's, you know, and obviously there's no way we could fit everything into a piece. This piece was already hugely long, and there were people saying, why didn't you talk about this? Why didn't you talk about that? We don't really seem to have a lot of really juicy sex scandals in Michigan. We had, you know, the occasional account of a lawmaker being caught with a prostitute or something, and there were a couple of those. So, yeah, I got to say, there is human nature. There is a certain, like, salaciousness to the Corser Gamrat scandal that maybe isn't present in some of these other things, and also we're not out of the woods on this one yet. The new details continue to unfold. Todd Corser continues to make Facebook posts, which you'd think someone closer to him would have revoked his internet access by now. So this, I think, is going to be pretty high on the list.
Detroit Free Press columnist Nancy Kaffer. And the story, The Seven Worst Political Scandals of in Michigan History, can be found at freep.com. Thank you so much for the lurid history lesson, Nancy.
You're welcome, Cindy. Thank you for having me.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Entrepreneurship.
Part of the community. The next idea.
We are the key to our own recovery.
It's tough enough to make it as an entrepreneur, but a recent set of experiments by researchers from the business schools at MIT, Harvard, and Yale strongly suggest it is even tougher if you're a woman. They found when it comes to listening to and judging an entrepreneur's pitch, the investors preferred men to women, even when the pitches were exactly the same. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea has seen this firsthand. Rachel Downs is Vice President for Entrepreneurial Strategies at Inforum. It's a professional organization for women. It is really, really good to have you with us, Rachel. Thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here, Cindy. Thank you.
This study that just came out shows that the pretty blatant biases that are at play in the startup world, I think we know why on more moral and fairness grounds that this should be corrected. But what's the business case?
Well, you know, Cindy, I would actually say that it's really unconscious bias that is at play here, and that we all hold stereotypes that are unconscious about roles that are appropriate for men and women. I don't believe that anyone wakes up and, you know, makes a decision to act in a way that could be, you know, interpreted as discriminatory in an intentional way. So I always like to say that the work that we do at Inforum is not designed to blame or shame people, but is really to elevate the issue and help people understand the business case for diversity. Scott Page is a researcher at the University of Michigan, and he's a statistician and brilliant researcher, and he talks about the fact that he can prove with mathematical certainty that any group that is working on a project in a company, you know, is trying to advance any initiative, can always achieve the highest return on investment and deliver the best results when you have the most diverse group working on the issue.
So let's take that and dig into this, Rachel. Why, in your view, is diversity so important for Michigan's entrepreneurial ecosystem?
Well, I think that everyone can agree that we're now operating in a global marketplace. You know, diversity is a critical issue, whether you're talking about gender, sexuality, age. You know, we now have four generations for the first time in the workplace, and I think it's important that if you're going to be developing solutions or products that appeal to the market, your companies should reflect the market itself.
Now, you have seen, Rachel, some of these biases emerge firsthand, especially when you've been the only female judge at startup competitions. Can you tell us more about one of these interactions? I'm wondering, what were you seeing that the men who were also judges weren't?
Well, Cindy, I think that it really comes down to perspective. And, you know, again, without kind of pointing fingers at anyone specifically, I have been involved in judging business pitch competitions and have been able to bring a different perspective and defend the business case of ideas that were presented by women that were not initially perceived to have a high growth potential. And one of the examples specifically was a young lady who was pitching at a regional collegiate competition, and she had a great idea to develop a methodology, really a support program, that could teach Masters of Fine Arts students the basic components of building and launching a self-sustaining, livable wage business around their craft. As a MFA student herself, she really talked about the fact that these programs are typically very focused on arts and don't cover the basics of business that give individuals the tools to build businesses around their personal passion and arts degrees.
And so that is something you could see the value in that, and you could kind of enlighten your fellow judges.
Absolutely. I mean, just from an economic and community development standpoint, there is a wealth of research and data that proves the economic impact of the arts, you know, whether it's a symphony orchestra or a museum. You know, these are critical factors of community development and placemaking, which is, you know, again, it's a really hot topic as we look to find ways to build sustainable metropolitan areas that attract young talent.
I'm speaking with Rachel Downs, who's Vice President for Entrepreneurial Strategies at Inforum, a professional organization for women. Rachel, in your essay for The Next Idea, you argue that creating an investment fund with a low barrier of entry would really, really help. How would this work?
I think that one of the fastest ways that we can change the landscape and improve access for women and underserved communities is by diversifying the investment community. In the last 3 years, we've had great success in introducing and educating women on the opportunity to become angel investors, really demystifying that process. We've been responsible for confirming 20 new angels in various angel investment groups throughout the state of Michigan. But I believe that there's still a tremendous amount of untapped capital and potential throughout the state of Michigan. And the way that we could activate those individuals is by really providing an introductory opportunity to get involved in angel investing. Again, I'm going to say that it's really about demystifying the process. An accredited investor is an individual who has made $200,000 in gross income over the last 3 years, or has a net worth of $1 million or more, excluding their primary residence. And there are many people who easily have, you know, meet that financial benchmark and yet have never been exposed or have any understanding of what angel investing looks like and whether that might be an opportunity for them to become engaged and support and seed new Michigan startups. You know, I always say that because Michigan and you know, really generated a tremendous amount of wealth based on the automotive industry, but we have this kind of cultural identity where we don't necessarily think about what it means to invest in the next generation of Michigan companies, as they have been doing on the East and West Coast for many decades now. Again, I think it's a tremendous untapped opportunity here in Michigan to help women and other underserved communities understand the opportunity to get involved. And what is typically available to them is the opportunity to participate in an angel fund or investment group. But normally the minimum investment is somewhere in the $25,000, $50,000 or $100,000 range. And this is very high-risk investing. Mm. So if we were to lower that barrier to entry and make it more accessible and reduce, mitigate some of that risk by perhaps having a minimum investment of $5,000 or $10,000, I think many more people would be interested in becoming involved.
Rachel, who could or who should take the lead in starting something like this?
Well, I think that, you know, there are many organizations throughout the state of Michigan, like Inforum, you know, other similar organizations that serve underrepresented communities would be, you know, the NAACP or the Michigan Black Chamber of Commerce. If there were a way that we could really activate these communities and help them understand the opportunity and the impact that we could have collectively, I think it would be very exciting.
Rachel Downs is the Vice President for Entrepreneurial Strategies at Inforum. You'll find her essay at the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. And as always, we welcome your comments on Facebook and on Twitter. Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thank you, Cindy.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What determines whether a prisoner should be paroled? In Michigan, that decision is partially informed by a risk assessment questionnaire called COMPASS. And my next guest believes that questionnaire measures for poverty rather than the likelihood of whether someone will reoffend. Sonia B. Starr is a professor of law at the University of Michigan. She co-directs the Center for Empirical Legal Studies, and she studied the use of risk assessment tools in criminal justice all across the country. So good to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sonia, run us through a typical scenario as a prisoner is nearing his or her parole date. And tell us about this questionnaire called Compass.
Compass is an example of what's known as an actuarial risk assessment instrument. There are a wide variety of these instruments that are being used by different states' courts in sentencing, in pretrial detention, and especially there's been a longer history of using them in parole decision making. And in Michigan in particular, the use of these instruments at other stages is a bit more novel and not really phased in on a statewide basis. But the parole board does make use of these instruments, in particular this one called Compass. So what is an actuarial risk assessment instrument? Well, it's a way of statistically predicting the defendant's likelihood of reoffending on the basis of a variety of different factors. Now, some of those factors are things like the defendant's criminal history. There will be a number of variables relating to that. Some of them are based on a psychological assessment, essentially, of the defendant's attitudes. And then others will be assessments of the defendant, or in the parole context, the prisoner's past and their identity. And it's the characteristics that focus on the defendant's background, demographics, socioeconomic identity characteristics. Those are the features about which I'm particularly concerned.
Why is that?
Compass, like many of these other instruments, includes a detailed assessment of the defendant's employment status and employment history, financial status, financial history, family background. So Compass, for example, considers whether the defendant's parents have ever been convicted or incarcerated, whether the defendant's parents use drugs, whether the defendant or any of his family members has ever been a crime victim, whether the defendant or the prisoner, rather, comes from a high crime neighborhood. Now, all of those factors count against the prisoner in terms of predicting the prisoner's future risk. And that is based on statistical assessment of past offenders that have similar characteristics. So all of this is based on empirical studies about what kinds of things are statistically correlated with future crime. This may all be well motivated to protect the public, to prevent incarcerating people unnecessarily if they don't pose a high risk, and to make sure we do incarcerate people who do pose high risk. So I don't question the motivations behind adopting an instrument like this, but I think that it is very dangerous to make the punishment that somebody serves for a crime turn essentially on their poverty, because all of those factors that I just mentioned, they're all just different measures of socioeconomic disadvantage. And basically every marker of socioeconomic disadvantage in these actuarial prediction instruments will get you a higher risk score and mean that you will end up likely serving more time behind bars.
So you're saying that this idea that they're measuring these markers, measuring probabilities and not the person's mind?
Well, what I mean is they're measuring probabilities in a group average way. That is, they're making statistical claims about a past group of people that shared the person's characteristics. So they're essentially lumping the individual prisoner in with other people who similarly, say, were poor or unemployed or had poor high school grades or their parents were incarcerated. All of those things may very well be statistically correlated with committing future crime. But it doesn't turn on the defendant as an individual, and it doesn't turn in particular on anything culpable that the individual has done. So it's essentially making the length of a person's incarceration depend on who they are and how much money they have, rather than based on their criminal conduct or things that are within their control. And I think that all that that can do is compound the tremendous socioeconomic disparity, and also, even though it doesn't consider race, these factors are also strongly correlated with race. And so I think it can only compound the racial disparity in our criminal justice system, even in a system that doesn't have official consideration of factors like that. We already have to worry about those kinds of disparities in the criminal justice system. But to use an actuarial instrument that essentially makes it official, the state wants to treat you more harshly if you're poor because you're poor, that's what it means to put something, to score something as a risk factor in an instrument that is then going to be taken into account in determining how long of a sentence you serve.
Missions.
That, I think, is a really noxious message for the state to send, and it can only compound the existing disparities that we have. And I've been particularly concerned about this happening at the sentencing stage. That's what my research has been on. But I think that many of the same concerns are raised at the parole stage as well.
And we're seeing this, certainly, as you said, Michigan is not the only state doing this. There's a strong move nationally toward this use of risk assessment instruments in the criminal justice system. Why has risk assessment gained traction across the country?
The movement nationally, at the sentencing stage, actually, many states are using this much more broadly than Michigan is. At the parole stage, almost every state that has discretionary parole is using this in some form. And I think the movement is based on a couple of things. One is this general appeal of scientific and evidence-based practice. There's this currency of this idea that we want practices to be evidence-based, grounded in data, that applies in a lot of different areas of law. And I myself, I'm an empirical researcher. I actually believe that criminal justice policy should be grounded in data. But I think that there are certain kinds of tendencies to rely on data that really are just a mask for discrimination. And I think that that is what is going on here, even with the best intentions. I think one of the reasons that this movement has gained steam is because of, again, a very well-intended desire by critics of our bloated system of mass incarceration to try to find a way to reduce the incarceration problem. And I want to give credit, actually, to the Michigan Department of Corrections for taking this concern seriously, because they've actually adopted a number of reforms all connected to the Michigan Prisoner Reentry Initiative to try to reduce arbitrary reincarceration, in general, to try to reduce reincarceration rates and reduce the percentage of sentence that at least some portion of defendants end up serving. There's a sense that incorporating risk assessment will allow this goal to be accomplished without threatening the public. Those are valuable objectives, and I do think we really need to do something about mass incarceration, but I don't think that relying on somebody's poverty or their demographics, also things like gender and age and marital status, those all go into the instruments.
I know, Michigan.
I don't think that relying on those things can be our path. I think we need to find a way to use evidence to inform our criminal justice system without building in these discriminatory bases for punishment.
Now, Michigan has been using Compass for the past 5-6 years in parole hearings, and the Corrections Department says Compass will reduce the prison population and cut costs. Do you think that's happened?
Doing a risk assessment doesn't itself reduce the risk, the prison population. A policy commitment to incarcerating fewer people reduces incarceration. We don't have to use Compass or any instrument that takes these poverty-related factors into account to decide who gets out. We could base it exclusively on what the person has done, both in this case and their past criminal history. And by the way, there's research suggesting that a tailored analysis of risk that focuses on criminal conduct can actually accomplish very similar predictive value in terms of somebody's future crime risk. You don't really gain that much in terms of prediction by also taking things like poverty into account. You know, Compass, for example, it has stuff about your past criminal history, but there is very little in the instrument that talks about the specific crime that you're serving the sentence for and the nature of it, what your role in the offense was. Maybe an instrument that took that into account in more detail could be much more defensible on fairness grounds while also getting reasonably good predictions of what risk you might pose in the future. You could really just have the legislature downgrading the sentencing ranges, which are often quite harsh, that apply to certain crimes, nonviolent crimes, things in which in general we can say that people who commit these crimes do not necessarily pose a big risk to the public. We don't have to say that the sentence for any given individual or the portion of the sentence that they actually serve behind bars should depend on who they are. We can just have our system not make quite as harsh judgments about what the punishment range should be for certain offenses that, in general, don't threaten the public.
Sonia, are there states using some kind of a risk assessment instrument that you think fits what you're talking about and not focusing on things like poverty?
Yeah, this is a new effort, but there's research funded by the Laura and John Arnold Foundation trying to develop and assess risk assessment instruments at the bail stage. At the bail stage, that's when courts have to decide whether to release the defendant in advance of trial, and one of the questions is whether they'll pose a risk to the public while they are released. So in many ways, it's a very similar predictive enterprise to what happens in parole. And there's this public safety assessment that some researchers developed for the state of Kentucky to use in pretrial release, and they have found that phasing that in enabled them to reduce crime by up to 15% among defendants on pretrial release, and that instrument shies away from using economic variables. So I think that it's possible to get considerable gains without relying on these kinds of instruments. I do want to say that I'm not totally sold on the idea of using actuarial risk assessments at all, though. I think that one could do what courts have traditionally done in sentencing and what parole boards did before they shifted toward using actuarial instruments, which is to rely a lot more on individualized assessments of the person's case and what they actually did and then what that tells us about what they might do in the future, rather than trying to make generalizations grounded in statistics like this at all. I'm not totally sold on the fact that we need an actuarial instrument of any sort, but it is certainly possible to design them without including these problematic variables.
Sonia, we know the parole board's big issue and big challenge is to decide that crucial question that does this person have the potential to be a danger? And a lot of people believe it's better to err on the side of keeping someone incarcerated rather than risk a crime being committed by a parolee. And they feel this helps to reduce that chance. And to that you say?
Reduce the chance that they will commit a crime in the future?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that's the rationale for it, then it is not necessarily consistent with the view that it's also a strategy for reducing incarceration, right? That is, I think it's true that a lot of times a high-risk assessment will lead to somebody being denied parole when they would otherwise be released. And that's a reason that I think it's not just that we're releasing the relatively privileged, it's that we're punishing people for being poor. And I think that's also likely when high-risk assessments are used at the sentencing stage. Now, I think there's no getting around the fact that both parole boards and sentencing judges are faced with a very difficult, morally challenging dilemma of how to treat an individual fairly while also protecting the public from crime. And I do think that protecting the public from crime is an important part of the mission of the criminal justice system. It's not all just about worrying about the defendant and what they deserve. But I do think that what the defendant morally deserves is a really important constraint on the state's ability to punish somebody. And I don't think that somebody deserves to be punished differently on the basis that they were once a crime victim, right? Or that their parents were a crime victim, or that their parents went to prison, or that they live in a high crime neighborhood, or that they don't have a variety of different privileges that other people have. Protecting the public is very important, but it's just not the only value that our criminal justice system has. There is a fundamental value of fairness and equity among people that is really important to the legitimacy of the criminal justice system. You know, mostly what protects the public from crime is not the fact that people are locked up, and it's not even the fact that people are afraid of getting arrested. It's that they have internalized the values of the criminal justice system. That is, that crime is not something that most people want to commit. And part of having a criminal justice system that helps people to share those values, to choose to comply with the law, all of that turns, I believe, in substantial part on the system being seen as fair and legitimate. And a system that says that your punishment is not just going to turn on what you did, it's going to turn on who you are and how much money you have. It compromises a lot of that moral legitimacy. And I don't know, I mean, it's a bold empirical claim to say that thus it might actually harm public safety. I don't know for sure what the net effects would be. But I think that it's definitely not impossible that in the end our efforts to protect public safety in this way might compromise the system so much that it will be unable to accomplish its justice promoting. The Supreme Court, in a case called Griffin, referred to the protection, or rather the equal treatment, of rich and poor criminal defendants, of all criminal defendants, no matter who they are, as the fundamental purpose, the basic aim of our entire justice system. I believe that that's true, that the idea that everyone stands equally before the courts and before the criminal justice system is a value that we should not throw away in the pursuit of a 1%, 2% gain, et cetera, in our ability to predict future crime and protect the public from it.
A view of actuarial risk assessments in the criminal justice system. We've been talking with Sonia B. Starr, who's a professor of law at the University of Michigan and the co-director of the Center for Empirical Legal Studies. Sonia, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And if you miss the program on the radio, you can always catch us on iTunes. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And while you're doing that, please give us a review. We would certainly like to hear what you think. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Shana Roth, and Katrina Schaefer. Joe Lindstroth is producer of The Next Idea. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.